Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. You're listening to NPR News. I'm Ewan Kerr. Norwegian journalist Åsne Sejersted examines what radicalizes people and why. Her 2015 book, One of Us, recounts how Anders Breivik, a right-wing activist who bombed a government building and then killed more than 70 people at a youth camp outside Oslo. It was the deadliest attack in Norway since World War II. Now she's out with another book, Two Sisters. The book tells the story of how two young Norwegian Somali women became radicalized and left their home in Oslo to join the jihad in Syria. The book also details their father's desperate attempts to save them. Sejersted recently visited the Twin Cities to talk at an event sponsored by the local literary organization Rain Taxi Review of Books. She came to the NPR studios to talk to me and reporter Mukhtar Ibrahim. Mukhtar, who now works for the Star Tribune, covered the radicalization of local Somali Americans during his time with NPR. We wanted to compare the experience here with what happened in Norway. Åsne Sejersted began by summarizing her story.
The story is about two Norwegian Somali sisters who were born in Somalia but grew up in Norway. And when they became teenagers, they found a great interest in their Muslim faith. And that process made them going further and further away from the central way of looking at religion, and they went to join ISIS in Syria. So that is what happened in 2013, and then the story is about their radicalization, their life in Raqqa in Syria, and how their parents are trying to rescue them from ISIS.
So how did you come to this story?
The story actually came to me. It was the father of the girls who wanted this story to be written. And
his name is Sadiq.
Yes, his name is Sadiq. And he wanted to be written for several reasons, I think. First of all, he said that when the girls had left home, they had been in shock. They hadn't understood what was this about, why. And then as months went by, they realized, and they got to learn more about radicalization, they realized that all the signs had been there, that the girls were almost like a textbook case of radicalization. And he wanted the book written to warn others, to tell this story, to warn other parents. And I think he also wanted to tell the world what he'd done, how much he'd fought to rescue them, because he felt that he failed as a father. When you have two daughters and they both leave you, of course, you people will think, well, what's wrong with that family? There is something there. So he wanted to show that, you know, it wasn't really anything wrong with our family. We just didn't understand what was going on. So he wants to, you know, tell how he tried to rescue them.
This, of course, would be a complicated story if it was just even happening in one town. But you came at the story after it had happened, and you're talking about people who are in Norway, Somalia, and also in Syria. How did you go about researching the story so you could tell it?
Yeah, it's like when you start working on a story, it takes you and it leads you wherever it needs to. So it's like the story and the events do decide. I started out in Norway, interviewing the family and the friends, and trying to find the background of their flight to Syria. And then it was important to try to follow their footsteps that went through Turkey and to the border of Syria. I did not cross because the girls were in ISIS territory, in the same territory where we had these terrible beheadings by other journalists. So it was really a no-go zone for me as a journalist. Sadiq, the father, went, but I didn't go. And then the story also took me to Somalia, or to Somaliland, because the mother had moved to Somaliland for a while after the girls had gone. She wanted to be with her family there. So I stayed some time in Hargeisa with her, and that's where the family is originally from.
There is a tremendous amount of information that you got too from, they had an online life too, which became important to telling the story.
Yeah, I think that many of those who left for Syria, they parts of the radicalization process, part of the recruitment was online. Even though very few got recruited or radicalized only through online pressure, it was often important to have groups of friends, or like these two sisters, that very often they went in groups. So, but they did have, as their beliefs grew in strength, they used also Twitter and Facebook to propagate their faith that they were very proud of. So there's a strong online community. There's also, or there used to be, a lot of information online from those girls who left earlier to Syria. Like everything from what they needed to pack in their bags, how to avoid suspicion from their parents or from the government. It was very, very open around the time they left, around 2013, 2014. Now all of that is gone. You don't find open Twitter accounts from Syria any longer. But that was an important way of finding information. And in this book, what is maybe like a backbone of the story is their online chats with their brother, where they really tell how life is from the first day they go to Syria and for several years on.
And I'd like to talk about that later, but I just wanted to ask, I mean, there's a great deal of concern about radicalization of young people here in different communities. What was the awareness of this issue in Norway at the time?
Well, when they left in 2013, it was kind of at the start. It had been going on. I mean, the last fighters would have gone in 2012, so just a year ahead of these girls. So they were little aware, and also in the beginning, it wasn't viewed as negative as it was later, because it was seen as a legitimate fight against Assad. And this was before the rise of ISIS. Like, if you remember, the first uprising in Syria was, well, people demonstrating. It was secular fronts. It was defectors from Assad's army. So this was something that the West could support for a while. And then, unfortunately, this conflict became very sectarian, also with the help of Assad, who opened prisons and sent out, you know, the worst religiously militant groups, because he wanted and he needed this war to become sectarian, for the world to only see there's an alternative between him and ISIS. So there wasn't so much attention. And when this girl started to become more and more militant and more fundamentalist and extremist, the teachers at school who did notice it, they just didn't know what it was. They thought, oh, it's probably their parents. It's probably the parents who are going to, you know, force them to marry. This is how they prepare them to go back to Somalia. Nobody had like the imagination to think that this is the girls who are thinking this. It's not their parents. A lot of the things that we know now and from my book, for instance, and from other books and from other reports, people didn't know that then, that they would go to Syria, even though they told some friends. So I've spoken to some of their friends now who knew about it and who knew how they got money, who planned this, and even some teenagers who wanted to go there with them, but who for different reasons did not go. So they are also some of the main sources to the stories, those who were on the same page as the girls, but changed their minds.
Our guest today is Åsne Saerstad, who is the author of Two Sisters Into the Syrian Jihad, which is now out in the United States. I'm also joined in the studio by Mukhtar Ibrahim, my colleague. And, you know, it strikes me, Mukhtar, that the similarities of what happened in this story to some things which have happened here in Minnesota. I mean, you have read the book too. You know, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the two stories are very similar. It seems like, you know, they are actually very identical. Of course, we have seen a number of young Somali American men have attempted to join ISIS, and some actually ended up joining ISIS in around that period, 2013, 2014. Reading this book and you know, learning about how, you know, you put together and what the families were going through is kind of very similar to what we have been hearing from parents who told us that, you know, there were warning signs in the early stages of, you know, the radicalization of these young men. But I think what the main difference here is the law enforcement were really onto this, you know, cases here in Minnesota. But I just want to know from your experience, you said in 2013 people didn't know what these young people were trying to attempt. What about the law enforcement side? Were they aware of this issue? Were they aware that, you know, Norwegians were trying to leave and join ISIS in that period?
Yeah, they were aware of it, but they didn't actually put down any measures to stop it. They felt that because these guys, what did they do? They just got on a plane to Istanbul. There's a direct flight. It's actually twice or three times a day, Oslo, Istanbul. It's like, you can't stop people unless you have a very specific suspicion. And at the time, it wasn't even illegal to join ISIS. That law came later. It actually came summer of 2013, so just before the girls left.
Was it as a result of what was happening at the time, like the sisters and that group joining
It was a result of two things. We've had, the only terror act we've had in Norway was a right-wing terror act in 2011 by Anders Breivik, who massacred 77 young people on an island. So we, from that, we did enforce our terror legislation, but it was also based on the fact that young men were joining the civil war in Syria. But they hadn't been aware of that so many girls were going. So I think that was the thing. These girls were in high school. They were, you know, good students. They were doing their homeworks. Nobody just had the imagination that they would go down and join as a holy war. But now a lot has been done. So I think now actually the police in Norway works very well with this as opposed to what they did in 2013. They have shattered many of those groups to pieces because many of those groups also they're quite criminal. There's many reasons to arrest some of these guys because they're not only Islamic terrorists, they're also very petty criminals. So they really has harassed or hassled them a lot. And that has, so now they're down with a broken spine. And of course, Norway is a quite transparent society. So it's easier to go into those groups and destroy them than it is in England or in France or even in Germany, where there are so many more and so stronger. And in the UK, they have, you know, they have a history and they have much longer history in the country. So in Norway, they've actually been doing quite a lot after the girls left.
What are the main difference between the two laws here in the United States and Norway when it comes to terrorism and radicalization?
Oh, I wish I knew the law here in the U.S. How is the law here? Can you tell me first?
The young men who were arrested for, you know, trying to join ISIS were, some of them were, you know, given a sentence of between 30 to 10 years. So, and it's just like trying to attempt to join a terrorist organization. So it's, you know, between, you know, 15, 20, 30 years.
Yeah, that's a lot longer than we have in Norway. But that's also, if you look at the whole legal system and sentences and verdicts, it's like the US and Norway's, you can't compare it. It's very different. We have much shorter sentences and we have a very different prison system that is based on that you're supposed to, you know, get back to society. So, and sentences of 50, 20 years don't really help you with that. So in Norway, it's illegal to join or try to join a terror organization. And there's one trial now. There was a young guy who'd also just tried, and he got like 2 years. So it's much shorter. And then some have come back, and they've been arrested, and they got like 6 to 7 years for being and fighting with ISIS. And even the girls, if they come back, they will be arrested. Everyone will be arrested. But the sentences might, for them, not be so long because they didn't actually fight. But even joining and facilitating, as a woman down in Syria for ISIS, they will be sentenced for having facilitated regime, even by cooking and cleaning or breeding children.
Well, tell us a little more about these two sisters, Ayan and Leila. At the beginning of their story, they were these feisty teenagers, kind of feminists. They didn't want to be pushed around. They were fighting for their rights. What was it that caused them to make this transition?
It's interesting because these girls are definitely, just as you say, girls who didn't want to be pushed around. And somehow that's also part of why they left, in their logic. So what I tried to find out was like, I wanted to find out whether, you know, whether it could be even logical to me, the fact that they left. And I looked at step by step. It's like one step at a time. So from one day to the next, the changes are not so big. But over a course of several years, like this radicalization process was, from being an ordinary teenager to suddenly standing at the border in Syria, because all the steps went in the same direction. So the reason there, of course, there's not one reason. And that's the same for, you know, when researchers and scholars write about this, it's not even one, you know, one common denominator or one factor. Had it been, it would have been easier to solve it. But there's a set of factors. Some are similar for others. We have to remember that most of those who've gone, and that's interesting to know whether that's same here in Minnesota. Of course, most of them are guys. And half of the guys have a criminal record with drugs or theft or violence. So these are, you know, most of the kids who went down to join ISIS were bad boys, street boys or street gangs. And so, but then half were not. And the girls were usually more pious, and it was a more, for these girls, for instance, it was a very religious radicalization. So one explanation for them is that they believe that life here and now is not real life. Real life is what happens after death. And this life is only important as a test. So the better you score, the better you behave in this life, the better position you'll have in heaven for eternity. So isn't that better than just have a, you know, a life here for short life for a few years? So that is something for them got really real. So whether it was praying or fasting or behaving or dressing or getting married early and just follow the book, they would even say things like, you know, the more we suffer here, the better, because the more suffering, the better position we'll have in heaven. But when you talked about them as feminists, that's also interesting. Most Norwegian women, even they, would be feminists. So that's like the way of life there. So they talk about their right to dress, their right to cover up, because they say in the West, we are forced to undress. So here, it's my feminist right to wear the niqab. And when they were not allowed in school to wear the niqab, not allowed to skip classes because they needed to pray 5 times a day or not wanting to do sports and things like that, when they were not allowed to behave as they wanted, they started petitions, they wrote letters to the municipality, to the county, to the school board, protesting to the headmaster. So they actually used all the tools that a liberal democracy had to give them in order to take away from themselves all those rights, which in ISIS, I don't know, they didn't like to be pushed around. Are they pushed around in ISIS territory? Were they, or did they just get a life just as they wanted?
It's really hard to get your head around, at least, and of course this is coming from my perspective as a European male, that someone would want to do what they did. But then again, I think also back to some of the religious mores were very prevalent in Scotland a while ago, and not that different, really, in the basis in terms of you suffer in this life for the next.
That's true. And wherever I go in Norway, there's always one or two in the audience who come up to me afterwards and say, you know, what you're telling us about is just as I experienced it in some evangelical churches, in some little village on the west coast in Norway, that were much more religious than other places. So that's true, that this is might be so very similar to some, you know, evangelical Christian beliefs, except from the violence.
So what was the attraction of Syria? Because by all accounts, life in Syria was going to be miserable.
Yeah, oh no, they didn't think that. They thought that this was God's state on earth. They think that this was going to be fair, this was going to be beautiful, this was going to be the right thing, the just thing. They would get a nice husband, they would get a house, which they did actually get. So for a while, life was not so bad for them. They got a villa, they got all the equipment they needed. And also the European jihadists came with money, so they were becoming like the elite in Raqqa in Syria. And then I think so we have to add the factor of adventure, of romance, of looking for meaning, looking for identity. We can't forget that they were actually, they think that they're doing the right thing and that this is what will give their lives meaning. And if you look at the propaganda at the time, there's no misery. It was just young guys on tanks or on horsebacks living a life, interesting, beautiful life in under the sunset and fighting for the right cause.
You, of course, I believe, still have not actually managed to talk to the girls.
No, they didn't want to speak to me. So it was a bit like writing a book about someone who's dead. What you do, you speak to their friends and their family and you go and see what they have written, what they've done, their actions. And the backbone, the spine of the book, I would say, is when they talk to their brother. Because
this is Ismail.
Ismail, they talk online, so everything is there. It's not like a conversation that disappears over the phone.
He is just slightly younger than them.
He is 1 year younger than Ayan.
Oh, he's in between.
He's in between Ayan and Leila.
Yes. Yeah, and their conversation starts 17th of October 2013, the day they leave. And it lasts for 2.5 years. And that is the place in the book where we actually do hear the girls' voices.
It's quite a tense conversation, too. I mean, they clearly love each other, but Ismail does not understand what they're doing. And it puts him on his own spiritual journey in a way, I think.
It does, and that is so interesting because they come from the same background. So it also shows that one family, the kids don't necessarily make the same choice. And also, they were going to the same Quran teacher who, according to the father, was the start of their nightmare. But whereas the girls were drawn more and more into his message, Ismail was first he didn't like the guy. He thought he was like pretentious and thought too highly of himself. So from the start, he was not convinced. And then after a while, he was a bit more disgusted by his message. And especially, he's the first who says this to the sisters. He's promoting death. He's romanticizing death, which is a big part of the ISIS culture. And then later, when he realizes that this is just a romance of death, this is also political, how this Quran teacher supports Al-Qaeda. This was pre-ISIS, so that didn't exist yet. And he warns his mother, and the mother doesn't want to listen to him. Because it's the mothers who actually have hired this Quran teacher to get their daughters back into Somali culture and way of life. So his spiritual journey, as you say, whereas the girls are becoming more and more extremist, he is losing his faith. So at the end of the book, he's become an atheist. He doesn't believe in God at all. And he writes to the sisters and he saying, when I see what religion did to you, I want nothing to do with religion. Something I had nothing against religion in the first place. But now I see, this is just stories. When I see the force of religion, the negative force of religion, I don't want to be part of it. So he's becoming a secular Norwegian, actually.
In the studio today, I'm Ewan Kerr with Mukhtar Ibrahim, and we are talking to Åsne Sarstad, who is the author of the new book, Two Sisters Into the Syrian Jihad. I'd like to talk a little about the father, Sadiq, who launched an incredible effort to get his daughters back. And it's an amazing story. He is so brave. He is so naive. He is occasionally duplicitous. he tells some pretty bad lies while he's on his... As you met Sadiq and talked to him about this, it must have been amazing to hear this story. I mean, what did you think as he told you what happened?
Well, when I met Sadiq at first, he said that, yes, his daughters had gone voluntarily on their own, but that now they were kept there against their will, that they were forced there by their husbands, that they were desperate to come home and that he needed to rescue them. So I believed in that story because why wouldn't I? Of course, anyone would want to escape ISIS territory. So for 1.5 years, I actually believed that because, and there were suddenly all these stories about how they fled from their husbands and how they were in hiding and how he needed to go in. And he wasn't fooling just me. He was fooling the police, whom he needed help from. He was fooling the Norwegian embassy in Istanbul, who sent people down to help the girls at the border, girls who were never, ever approaching that border. So he set up this big, big system and rescue mission in his head. It didn't happen. When I realized, and that was actually when I got the chat logs from Ismail, and I see this doesn't add up. This doesn't, there's no match here. So I see the girls have never been in hiding. They never fled from the husbands. They're there. They're happy baking pancakes, as they wrote about, in Raqqa with sugar topping or Nutella. So they were just like, this was a time where life for ISIS wives were quite okay, depending on which husband you got, of course. But for several, it wasn't bad. I had to confront Sadiq about the inconsistencies of his story, and I just was gathering as much as I could to plan how to, you know, confront him. And then in the end, when I did that, after that, we didn't speak for months, because he was very angry when I said that you have no credibility. You've tried to feed me with all those lies.
Did you think the project was over?
No, I thought it became much more interesting. Because one thing is like you have this grieving father and then you have the brave father. And it's like, okay, fine. You have a brave father and he is very brave. And I think his background is important, the fact that he was a child soldier in Somalia. So for him to go down into a war zone, it felt easier for him than it would for any other father who'd never been into a war, and how.
But he also knew what he was getting into and how dangerous it was.
Definitely, but I think if you've been a soldier once, he was on a mission, but now it's like, okay, so it's not just a brave and a grieving father; it's a father who's living in a parallel world too, who's desperate to get his daughters back, but he's also desperate for recognition. I realized what a blow it was to him as a father, not just only losing the girls, but the fact that they chose to stay there and not coming back with him, because he actually met them down in Syria. They didn't want to come back with him. And of course, what a blow to a father, because he knows that what we all know, that they might easily die down there. So they choose death over, you know, being at home with their father. And that was so painful. So he had to pretend that they were kidnapped there, down there.
He was also financially in a bad position, right? How did this affect his well-being in terms of supporting for his family? And
Yeah, well, this is a family who live solely on welfare. He never really worked. So, well, he had some jobs now and there, but it's like not really. The mother never worked. She never learned Norwegian. She never held a job. So this is a family was, you know, hanging on. But then when he had to do all those trips to Syria and paying smugglers and paying guards and paying for weapons, of course, that was out of his budget. And that's also how he needed to get money from other sources. So that's how he started to sell stories, he hooked up with different people to pay to those smugglers he was a one-man business and rescue mission.
Can you tell us a little bit about how Sadiq and Sara raised those their kids, and what was their reaction to when two of their daughters ended up leaving the family?
So they came to Norway when the three oldest kids were 6, 5, and 3. And Sadiq is quite adaptable, it seems, to other cultures. So I would say that he became quite a liberal guy who understood the society he lived in, Norway. But then you have Sarah, who is traditional, illiterate, never had any education except from a few, Quran classes. And I think that's interesting. I don't know how that is here, but the Somali communities in Norway, the kids are very much raised by the mothers. So the mothers have a lot to say over their whole childhood. And of course, there's a big conflict there. Like the person who's not integrated, the person who cannot read any of the messages from school or any other thing, like she's the one to guide her children into a new society. And then when the girls become teenagers, she is afraid to lose them to Norway because she's afraid of Norway because she doesn't know it. She lives in her head. She's still in Somalia.
What does she think about the Norwegian life?
Very afraid of it. That's what she told me. And she was afraid that the girls would just melt into the Norwegian society and she would never get them back. She saw their skinny jeans and their T-shirts. She was afraid they would go to parties or start drinking and getting boyfriends. And that's why she went to the Quran teacher. So she and her girlfriends, so her only group of reference, are other Somali women who are just as little integrated as herself. And they discuss what to do with our teenage girls. And then they go to the local mosque. They tell them, oh, you should hire this guy. He's 19 years old, good looking, young Somali, great teacher, Quran teacher, and that's going to get your girls back. And it did for some. And it's like for a while, Sarah was really pleased. They threw away their jeans and they bought long skirts and shawls and headscarves and started to stop seeing their Norwegian friends. Stopped going to anything related to, school parties, things like that, and started to sit at home and pray and go to the mosque. So she was happy for a while until she also saw that she did not like the niqab, the full covering, because she says that's not Somali culture, that is Arab culture. But she didn't see how extreme they were because she wasn't out looking at that. How is that in here? Do in Minnesota, the Somalis in Minnesota, are they usually brought up by their mothers?
Yeah, it's mostly the mothers usually stay home and raise the kids, and the fathers usually go out and work. So yeah, you are right. The mothers have a big influence on how the kids are being raised. Unlike Norway, there are not a lot of females who attempted to join ISIS or went to Syria to join ISIS. There's only one case of a woman who left Minneapolis to join ISIS. So it's mostly male who went into that route. Yeah, but Sadiq and Sarah, you're right, they are, the mother especially is trying to hold on to her culture, and also at the same time she's fearful of losing her kids to become probably atheist or not religious. And when they become religious, they are, proud of what their kids are doing. So is that what you have seen throughout your book, when you're doing the research in your book, in other families?
The thing is
the crisis of identity and where...
Yeah. I think that's very important. And there were different cases with different families. And I realized that the role of the mothers were really important, good and bad, because you also have a girl in the book, Amal, who is going through the same process as the two sisters and going to the same Quran teacher and going to the same organizations and wants to join them. But then she has a working mother. A working mother who held several jobs and are out in the society, and she sees and notices the changes in her daughter. And when the daughter says, I want to quit school, I'm harassed. And then she asks, harassed by whom? Oh, by my classmates. And then the mother just tells her, your classmates haven't changed. You have changed. I will call your teacher. She calls the teacher and the teacher says, yes, we're also very worried. And she spends a lot of time with Layla, who's the youngest sister. And then this mother started to investigate, and then she realized what it was, you know, what was happening. And she talks to the daughter, she, you know, takes control of her passport and of, you know, just like questions her. And that girl is now studying at university. Everything is going well because this radicalization can be stopped. It could be a window of time where that sounds like the thing to do and it's full of adventure and romance and the right thing. But if you stop it at the right time too, kids can be diverted in a better direction. So this girl is studying, whereas these two other girls, the two sisters, we don't even know if they're still alive.
We're talking today with Åsne Seierstad, who is the author of Two Sisters, and which has just come out in the US. I have to ask you, what reaction was there to the book when it came out in Norway?
We have, I mean, I got a lot of good reactions, and it was actually, it came as a shock to people because people didn't know that this was happening in Norway. And they're reading the papers about kids going to Syria, but they didn't know to what extent there were these very strict Islamic fundamentalist organizations and mosques operating inside of Norway. So this was a big hit, actually. It was the most sold book in 2016 and in 2017. And that was including all categories like crime and everything. So it's like read by everyone, read by everything from young Somali girls, which was like, you know, for me, that's, of course, that warms me the most, that you reach a new readership, people who might never have ever read my books before. So I get a lot of letters and or on Messenger and so on from young Somali girls or other immigrant girls, actually. And I'm glad that they're thankful to the book, because I was very afraid when I wrote the book. I was very afraid that someone would say that I was like anti-Muslim or anti-Somali, although she's too negative against the Somalis. But luckily that didn't happen. At least that didn't come to me. There might be something written about that, but not that I'm aware of. And then, of course, you have the big Norwegian readership who are just like, oh, this is happening right now, here and now in our schools. And it's also now much read by the police, by the schools, by educators, law enforcement too. I know that they read the book. So it's like, because it's so detailed and it tells you about the inner process. And very few books have done that, even here in the US, or including here in the US. There are not that many books that go and tell you and makes you kind of understand the inner process, what drives and inspires these young people to go or to join a very brutal terror organization.
You're very well known here. I mean, you've written many, many books, but here in the US, your book, One of Us, The Story of Anders Breivik and the Massacre in Norway, attracted a lot of attention. This is the story of the man who killed 77 people, many of them young people at a summer camp. Did you see parallels between these two stories, between this radicalized right-winger and what happened to these two girls?
Yes, I think there's a trend now, both in Europe and in the US, of extremism. You have both right-wing growing, both here and in Europe, and you have the Islamic radicalization that has been growing. We see how it will happen now that ISIS is curbed, whether that will change anything, whether it will stop growing. But what is similar to those trends, like you have the fascist trend on one side and the Islamo-fascist trend on the other side, is one in their ideology, this idea that you can cleanse societies, that if we only get rid of, whether, you know, Nazi Germany, the Jews, or today, you know, if we get rid of the Muslims or the gay people or whoever, you know, then everything will be okay. Or you have the Islamo-fascist in ISIS saying, if we get rid of anyone who's not a pure Muslim, like any Shia Muslim or Yazidi or Jews, then we can, you know, make a perfect state. So this idea of purification, this thinking of black and white, like either you're with us or you're against us. And also when you look at those who join those organizations, there's also similarities. Like also in the on the fascist side, many of them are street boys who've been in contact with the police, coming from homes or instability. That's of course the majority on both sides. Are guys like that. And of course, if you feel weak, you want to be with something strong. You want to join something strong. And the thinking of being part of the group is important. Like these books, both my book about Anders Breivik and this book is a book about belonging. Where do I belong? Who am I? My identity. We all want to have a group. It's part of the first step to radicalization. It's usually like you put yourself outside the group. You say, I'm different from the majority. I'm not one of them. And the thought of victimhood is important too. Like Anders Breivik, he called himself, we Europeans are now victims to the Islamization of Europe. There will be no more blue eyes or blonde hair on the streets of Europe if we let these immigrants take over. So he sees himself as a victim to Islamization or mass immigration. And then you have these girls who sees themselves as victims, as Muslims. Like they think or they believe that Europe doesn't want them because that when they look at Europeans, they look at fascists. They don't look at the general person who doesn't, you know, have strong opinions about them. But they like to say that we are harassed, we are not accepted, we are not free, we can't dress as we like, we can't live as we like. So Norway to them became a prison. And the journey to Syria also has to be seen as some kind of a liberation process.
So the book is finally out in the United States. What do you hope American readers will take away from your story?
Well, I do hope that they will try to get inside the minds of these girls and others in the book, because I think that's what literature can do. It's the communication between the book and the reader. It's not like just news, information online or in a newspaper where you're just you being informed. If you sit there with the book, if you don't use your own experience and your own thoughts, if you don't add that into the text is dead. So that is like the text becomes alive in this cooperation. So any reader who could be, you know, could be a teacher, an educator, could be a psychiatrist, could be a policeman, student, like all sorts of different readers, a Somali housewife or professional, you know, all different readers will put themselves into it and hopefully see some patterns and examples that could be important for them in their lives.
Åsne Sarstad, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.